Hi, I'm Max Linsky, and today on The Books That Changed Us, Rebecca Traister. She's the author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, and a writer for New York Magazine and The Cut. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Rebecca Traister. I'm a journalist and I write books about gender, power, politics, and culture in the United States.
Is there one book, Rebecca, that you remember inspiring you to be a writer?
So this is a question that's really sort of confounding for me. I don't remember deciding to become a writer. That's the first thing that's key to understand why I have trouble with this question. And there's a very specific reason for this, and it has to do with books. I grew up in a house that fetishized books, in a family that fetishized books. Both my parents are English professors. My father's a rare book librarian and a book collector, and I grew up with 40,000 books in my house, and I read voraciously from the time I was a child. So there are millions of books that have left lasting impressions on me and shaped me, and I'm excited to talk about some of them. But to me, being a writer was like being a movie star. Because it was the thing that was the most fetishized in my house. And for whatever screwy psychological reason, it never crossed my mind, I don't think. I mean, I have a vague memory of being 9 or 10 years old and like trying to write a picture book. But that was like the only memory I can summon of thinking as a young person that I would ever be a writer. It felt too magic to me to be able to do it. And I worry that this sounds like false humility here, right? But in fact, there are plenty of times now that I am a writer that I read books and I'm like, this book is crap. Like, how this book get published? Like, I don't want to just be like, wow, I never thought I could write books because it's such a special skill. And I, little old me, couldn't do it. I now very frequently will have a sensation when I'm reading something that's like, wow, I would have, like, I could have told this story better. So I don't want to pretend to be some, like, sweet kid who's like, I just can't imagine anybody who can write a book. Like, now I'm, you know, a bitch about it.
Was there some moment it turned? Like, when did it stop being magic? When did you realize I could do this too?
I learned reporting as in the most unglamorous way possible, which is as a trade, which is appropriate. I learned it as like plumbing and like how to put pipes together is like how to write a lead, how to cultivate sources, how to call sources, how to write a kicker, how to meet a deadline, how to write to length, how to do all this stuff just like... It wasn't artsy fartsy and it wasn't. And I was told directly, nobody cares what you think, Rebecca. Nobody cares what you think. You're a 25 year old. Nobody cares what you think about things. You just need to get the information.
Right. And you had to learn like the very nuts and bolts of how you do a magic trick.
Yeah. And I do remember, you know, the first time that a story of mine was published, which was a long time after I'd started working as a fact checker. And I remember being excited about it. And I remember being shocked that my parents, while happy for me, did not think that it was a piece of magic. it was a bad story, which is fine. Great. But the process of learning to be a journalist sort of divorced the sense of like glamour. There was not a lot of glamour. There was not a lot of glamour.
All right. So if there is no book that inspired you to be a writer, is there a book from your childhood or your teens or something like that, that sticks out as like the most magical?
I can tell you, I think a pair of books that I read, and I've been thinking about them a lot because as we speak, I am in the house that my mother grew up in Northern Maine, where I happened to have the summer where I read both of these books. So the summer that I was, I believe 10 or perhaps 11, I first was at a relative's house where I found my aunt's house, where I found a copy of The Handmaid's Tale. And I'm 99% certain that this is the first adult book that I read, which is 12 kinds of fucked up. And I just picked it up and I remember distinctly my mother and my aunt exchanging glances over my head like, should she be? And then sort of shrugging like, oh, I want to read it. So I read The Handmaid's Tale, and it would be extremely neat with me as a feminist writer to tell you that this opened up my world into understanding like dystopian patriarchal universes that, you know, might not be that distant in my future. It totally did not. What I couldn't put it down because, like a soap opera, I had to know what happened next. And the things, the details I remember are like Offred using a pat of butter as moisturizer on her skin, right? And and the sex and the stuff that any 10 or 11 year old would be like, woo, hello, right? And that's actually completely my memory of that book. I don't remember coming away from it with any conscious political thoughts, though I also leave open the possibility that it unconsciously shaped me in some profound way. But then I went on to, this is like, I never went to summer camp as a kid. I was never sent to camp. And so, and my mother often taught, she's a college professor who taught summer school. And so we were shipped to this farm where she grew up, a potato farm in northern Maine, to be with my grandparents. And so I was in my grandparents' house, and it was the same summer that I had read The Handmaid's Tale. And I was feeling like, wow, I could really take on another adult book. And laying around the house was Isabel Allende's The House of the Spirits. Okay. And I don't know if you know this, but it's a multi-generational saga about a political dictatorship. Like, it's a completely political, multi-generational saga. And I picked it up and again retained zero politics and all of the, like, oh my God, like, there's a lot of sex, there's a lot of unrequited love, there's a lot of, right? And I, like, vacuum cleanered that book. I mean, I think I, in this house, I can look at a chair on the porch and remember where I sat on that chair with The House of the Spirits and didn't get up for 2 days.
Oh, that has to mean that it set in pretty deep in some way, right?
I guess. I don't know. I remember that summer my brain exploded because I was like, wait. And it's not, I don't want to pretend that I made these conscious connections, but the kind of, and I, of course I'd felt a version of it with kids' books insofar as, like, I couldn't wait to read. There was a whole bunch of Madeleine L'Engle books that were sort of about preteen women and science. And, but at the time, the kids' books, which I also, of course, loved and would just zip through, were short, you know? And this was something I could get completely immersed in, and long, right, lengthy narratives where the characters connected to each other. Anyway, this has nothing to do with my work, except that those are my formative book memories.
Well, I that idea of being totally enveloped for the first time feels real to me and pretty familiar. I love the idea that you're like, I don't think I was that precocious a kid. We're just reading The Handmaid's Tale when I was 10. I think, like, maybe that counts.
But taking away almost not truly. I mean, I went back to read The Handmaid's Tale. Okay, The Handmaid's Tale is a book that, because of my work and because of my later professional and personal investments in feminism, I would return to again and again, right? I've now read The Handmaid's Tale probably six times. And The Handmaid's Tale is very interesting about books that you read at different times in your life and what you take away from them. I had probably read The Handmaid's Tale in college, maybe as a young adult. I mean, I don't remember the sort of intervening times. But in the beginning of the Trump administration in 2017, I went back and I read it for work. And I had never read it since I'd had kids. And let me tell you, Max, I had read that book as a cogent adult multiple times. I had no memory that that woman had a child in it. It had just not, like, there's, I mean, scenes that as a parent, I was like, ooh, I can't read this. It's too, like, being her child being taken from her in the woods as they're trying to run and escape. I had read this book as an adult. And if you had asked me, like, for $1 million, does Offred have a child before Gilead? I would have been like, nope, no memory of that whatsoever. Think
See, that's why it's like, the 10-year-old Rebecca also got something out of that book. You know, you just, you see something different in the painting every time.
You sure know? Do. It's incredible.
Okay. Is there one book that you can think of that changed you in some fundamental way?
Yeah. A book that totally changed me in an unexpected way and that it occurred to me out of the blue is Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And
tell me why.
I had never been somebody who studied poetry. I had never been somebody who gave Walt Whitman 2 seconds worth of thought, except for having read, you know, probably Crossing Brooklyn Ferry and Song of Myself in some American literature lecture class, survey class as a freshman or something in college. When I was a senior in college, I had a professor who was an American studies professor who I actually knew personally because I babysat for her kid. And she was a Whitman specialist. And I babysat for her daughter and was very close, but hadn't taken a class from her. And I decided to take her Whitman class, even though I had no particular interest in Whitman, because I sort of felt like it was the proper thing to do. I don't know, you know.
Right.
And reading that book with the guidance of a very brilliant teacher made me think totally differently about poetry, identity, and the country in a way that I think in retrospect is probably problematic in its own ways. You know, I think often about how some of the books that I did study as somebody who studied American literature were like super white. Faulkner, Whitman, Willa Cather's My Antonia, all this stuff that was really, really powerful for me in terms of how I began to understand the United States and an investment in it is told from a white perspective. Even when it is trying to deal with issues like, as Whitman did, race, immigration, or like Willa Cather did, immigration, and but without really looking at the stealing of land from indigenous populations. So, but absolutely, Walt Whitman made me think about citizenship and a writer's role as a citizen in a different way, because Whitman's work was so invested in his view of what it meant to play a role in the United States as it changed. And, you know, the coming together of the Union through the Civil War, he was so invested in New York City as a living, breathing thing. And it made me see the United States in a different way and a writer's relationship to the United States in a different way. And if I look back, I actually think that the book that was from a Black perspective that had the same impact on me that I could never have articulated it was much earlier, a book that I read in high school for the first time. I've read it many times since, was Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. And I thought a lot in college when I was reading Walt Whitman, and I wish I could go back and interview 21, 22-year-old me and find out why, like what connections I was making at the time between Whitman and Zora Neale Hurston. But just seeing the nation that you're living in as part of the, as like a living part of the story that you're telling.
Mm-hmm. Were those ideas things that you were actively thinking about, and reading Whitman and reading Zora Neale Hurston shaped it? Or was the experience of reading those books that you thought about those ideas for the first time?
I think that with Whitman, it was when I was consciously thinking about those ideas for the first time. And then that made me go back and think about some of the stuff I'd read when I was in high school. Having said that Whitman's perspective was so white, I now think of the fact that Whitman's poetry in that class that I took, it wasn't just Zora Neale Hurston. I also went back and thought about Invisible Man, which I'd read in high school, in a different way. And I think that's probably screwy, that thinking about the nation and its inequities through Whitman's lens, which is really optimistic and really positive, and really Whitman loves the United States. But thinking about it now, I do realize that as white as his perspective was, it sort of opened up ideas for me about a writer's role with regard to framing the story, telling the story of the nation, that made me go back and think about other books that I had read in high school that were not from a white perspective. So thinking about Ellison, thinking about Zora Neale Hurston.
That was a great answer.
You know, it is. It's interesting. We're constantly revising ourselves, which is also has resonance with Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, which he was constantly revising over a period of I don't remember how many years.
Rebecca, you took this deep sigh when you began that answer and took this deep sigh at the end. Why?
Because I think so much of thinking about what we read and how we react to it is maybe if I were a book critic, or maybe if I did a job like my parents and my job was thinking about what I read and my experience as a reader, maybe I would think differently about this. But for me, excavating reactions that I've had in the past can be very painful because I'm very often critical of what I missed or what I didn't understand. And because recognizing the things that you love and that shape you with a later perspective on how those
things are themselves flawed and have shaped you in ways that are screwy can be really challenging and painful, you know?
Yeah.
I had an experience maybe a year and a half ago where I was at a book festival in Wisconsin, and I was on a panel where we were to read passages that had been meaningful to us from books. And My Antonia, which is another book that I read in high school, found completely boring. Like, I couldn't believe it. I read it in eighth grade, which I think was a little early for it, probably. It's a little slow.
Not that you're precocious or anything.
For eighth grade. No. It was assigned. That one was assigned in class. And I was like, this is really boring. I did not enjoy, I revolted against a lot of my assignments. I never read Lord of the Flies. I got two chapters in and I was like, this is shit. And I just never read it. And I faked a paper on it and like never read it. But we had to read My Antonia in eighth grade. And I just thought it was incredibly dull and boring. And then I went back as a young adult and I read it. And it became one of my favorite books, you know, in my sort of top five or whatever personal books that I had a deep and strong reaction to. And so I was at this book festival a year and a half ago, and we were asked to read a passage from a book that was very meaningful to us. And I read a passage from My Antonia. And one of the other writers who was there talked about, like, and I talked about how it was very interesting to me because it made me think about the paths worn by immigrants across the country. And one of the other panelists there pointed out, like, that it doesn't include all that was erased from the country when the immigrants, you know, when European populations moved across the country, there's no reflection in this book that was, you know, of the indigenous people who were moved out of their way. And I was like, I'm so disappointed in myself that I could have read this book so many times. And that is, I didn't think about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about it. And that is, I'm so glad that I had that experience. It's not the discomfort of it doesn't only makes it more valuable, you know, but it is uncomfortable in a good way, but also like to go back and interrogate how you've absorbed art and culture and without asking crucial questions about it. And that's part of the project of any time we go back and look at the books that we loved and we hated and we found boring and we found exciting and we found romantic and we found, you know, going back any distance, including to a year and a half ago or, you know, right, 6 months ago, means uncovering all the things that get built into us and that it's our job to unbuild.
Right. And like, that's kind of what we've been talking about the whole time, which is like, sometimes what you will see in it is some profound blind spot. And sometimes what you'll see in it is moisturizing tips.
Right. In the same book.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right. I got one more question for you.
Yeah.
When you were writing one of your books, maybe the last book, but you can choose, was there a book that was particularly inspiring to you that helped you get across the finish line writing your book or helped you think about what your book could be? Is there one book that sticks out in that way?
There is a book that sticks out for me professionally as the absolute model of what literary nonfiction can be. But I want to say that it's hard for me when I'm in the process of writing a book. I am constantly reading because I'm constantly reading for the research for whatever I'm doing. But it's very hard for me to read for pleasure and even sometimes for modeling while I'm in the midst of writing because those other voices get in my head and they wind up sort of infiltrating my writing voice. And so I read like for research purposes, but I don't necessarily read alongside my own writing of a book. When I do, it can sometimes make it complicated. And the book that I'm about to cite is actually, I'm hesitant to even use it as like, it's not a model for me because there's not a comparison between what I've written so far. Yes, I would aspire to write a book like this. For me, the model of narrative nonfiction is The Warmth of Other Suns, the Isabel Wilkerson book, which is, I think, one of the, in my top three books of all time in professional, personal categories, like the most remarkably compelling narrative in which people are brought to vivid life as this history of the country is just etched out in such remarkably compelling detail. That book to me is by many measures a perfect book. And if you write narrative nonfiction, and I tend to read, as you can tell from my answers, like I'm a novel person, I'm a fiction person, but I just think it's an extraordinary piece of work. every sentence down to like every word. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book, beginning to end.
You called it perfect. Is that your goal when you write these books? Do you want to write a perfect
book? I will never write a perfect book. I mean, that's like other people write perfect books. A couple other people write perfect books. Very few. No, I'll never. I mean, I'm like a workmanlike writer. I'm a good writer. I'm not going to discount what I do. And I strive to be a better writer. But I'm still a little bit of a plumber, you know? And it's okay. That's okay. Like, I feel extraordinarily shocked and lucky and aware of the many advantages I've had that have permitted me to live this life that I used to think was a movie star's life. It's not a movie star's life, but but I'm not a person who's going to write a perfect book, though I'd love to aspire to be one.
Rebecca, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Max.
The Books That Changed Us is made in partnership with Longform and MailChimp Presents. The show is produced by Janelle Pfeiffer, art by Joelle Avellino, music by Aaron Lammer. Thank you to Rebecca Traister for sharing the books that changed her. You can find the whole By the Books lineup at MailChimp.com/presents.